So, by now we've probably all heard of antiheroes, right? The dark, gritty version of the hero. The one who doesn't mind kicking the dog or stealing candy from a baby if it ultimately gets them what they want. When you think about it, they really look like bad guys. It's just that what they want happens to be a good thing, which, from an audience perspective, makes them insanely complex to think about. We even did a whole video about it, just trying to untangle the line between where anti-hero and villain is. But there's another side to this too, one that I rarely see explored. What would you call the opposite of that? The bright, soft version of the villain? The one who doesn't mind saving the cat or helping an old lady across the street? What happens when, for all intents and purposes, a character seems like a good guy, but they still want to blow up the city? That, my friends, is what we call an anti-villain. And if you thought anti-heroes were complex, I promise you, you haven't seen anything yet. It can be pretty hard to find opportunities to do really experimental stuff as a content creator. Usually that kind of thing is pretty risky and can end up costing a lot of money. Nevertheless, we have managed to do some pretty weird stuff. Like this video about a fantasy setting that basically has gigantic geographic genitalia, or this video about crafting living beings with magic. But the coolest thing we've ever done, hands down, our 6-part original series, Worldsmiths, which explores some of the most unique fiction by some of the most unique authors. Junji Ito's weirdly pleasant psychological world of horror, Neil Gaiman's darkly honest approach to writing children's stories, and a bunch of others. We put so much effort into that series, and we are just so proud of it. And the reason we got to do all of that? This stuff that would just be a bit too risky to try here on YouTube. Our streaming platform, Nebula. We literally get paid to do experiments over there. So if you want to see us try more weird and interesting stuff, visit go.nebula.tv/tailfoundry and sign up for just $2.50 a month. There are a ton of other creators experimenting over there too, so once you're done with our stuff, you'll have plenty left to explore. But definitely look at our stuff first. Again, visit go.nebula.tv/tailfoundry and go watch our original series, Worldsmiths. Now, back to the video. The first thing we want to do is draw some boundaries for what a villain even is. First of all, the villain is not the antagonist. I mean, it usually is, but it doesn't have to be. Where an antagonist is just a villain that gets in the way, a villain is, importantly, a bad guy. They aren't just an obstacle or a jerk. The thing that they want is actually morally wrong. So that kid who the protagonist is competing with in the baseball playoffs, antagonist, not villain. On the other hand, criminal mastermind who wants to take over the world? Villain, of course. But these days, very few villains are just that. The rise of the antihero is occurring in concert with the rise of the anti-villain. In fact, some of the only places you really see these pure evil villains these days are in high fantasy, where they're often some kind of mysterious force of darkness, or in works made for children that need a more generic, mustache-twirling baddie. Outside of that, they're most often found in comedies, where they're lampooned for the utter unrealisticness of having no positive traits whatsoever. At one point in the recent movie Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, which is fantastic by the way, please watch it, the villain Big Jack Horner gets his hand on a magical talking bug that introduces itself as his conscience. A fun little parody of Jiminy Cricket from Disney's adaptation of Pinocchio. Throughout the movie, the little bug makes increasingly desperate attempts to find some shred of goodness in the irredeemable Jack, until eventually he is forced to admit that no such thing exists. Jack is just a genuinely bad person. It's honestly so much fun to watch. If the movie didn't take advantage of Jack's moral bankruptcy to make a lot of really great, irreverent jokes, this character would probably just be incredibly boring. Evil all by itself is just one note. It can be hard to make compelling. Without some way to add intrigue, like a good sense of humor, these characters just feel like cardboard cutouts painted the color evil. Fortunately, it's not an either-or situation. You can have a villain that is just a villain and also give them some fun depth of character. You can even make the audience like them. There's a throwaway character in the show Rick and Morty named Crumbopulous Michael, who is impossible not to like, even though he's an alien assassin.
Nice to meet you, Morty. Listen, if you ever need anybody murdered, please give me a call.
You're giving him a card?
I have no code of ethics. I will kill anyone, anywhere. Children, animals, old people, doesn't matter. I just love killing.
He only has a couple of minutes of screen time in the entire series, but he's still an audience favorite.
Oh boy, here I go killing again.
But just because a villain is likable or funny doesn't make them not a villain. Just as good doesn't necessarily mean nice, nice doesn't necessarily mean good. Perhaps the most common type of likable villain is what TVTropes.org calls the wooby villain. The idea is that if you attach enough tragic history to a character, it will soften all their sharp edges and make them feel less like a villain. And fair enough, I guess that does work, but it doesn't change the fact that they're a villain. Yes, it's tragic that your family was murdered by penguins. No, that doesn't mean your penguin genocide revenge plot is okay. Okay, so, antagonists, comedically dark villains, villains with depth, villains we like, villains we feel sorry for. These are all fun approaches to giving our villains a bit of depth, but they aren't anti-villains. At the start of the video, I gave a pretty basic description of anti-heroes and anti-villains. The anti-hero might be dark and gritty, they might do bad things, but they ultimately want something good, and strive to get it, which makes them heroes. On the other hand, although they may be pleasant, may even do good things, anti-villains ultimately want something bad, which makes them villains. Really, what it comes down to is goals. The methods and motivations behind those goals can change, but at the end of the day, it's the net result of what the character does or tries to do which decides their morality. Thanos from the Marvel Cinematic Universe is actually a really great example of this. His ultimate motivation is to bring balance to a cosmos that he sees as overpopulated. He wants to save it. His method for pursuing this motivation is ruthlessly tearing apart every world he comes to in search of the tools that will enable him to do the work. And his goal? His goal, in plain terms, is to murder half of all living beings in the universe at the same time. So, he may be motivated by a good ideal, but his ultimate goal is evil. He's a villain, despite a weirdly altruistic core ethos. This is what an anti-villain looks like. Although it's also probably like the most vanilla version you can possibly find. Big purple evil man wants to murder half of all the people, but, you know, it might help the ecosystem. Not a huge moral quandary there. Like I said earlier, this gets far more complex. If a villain is a character with goals that we understand to be bad, then there are two types of anti-villains. One with an evil goal but good motives, and another with an evil goal but good methods. It'd certainly be easier if they had names, wouldn't it? Luckily, we have TVTropes.org to help us. That is, when we aren't getting hopelessly lost in article browsing. That site is so addictive. The noble anti-villain is basically just a villain with some kind of code of ethics or code of honor that they follow. For them, the end does not always justify the means. Their goal may be evil, but their methods are more scrupulous, more honorable than those of other villains. This is sometimes as simple as an honor among thieves dynamic. Think of the Thieves Guild in the Elder Scrolls games, which has a strict no-killing policy. Useful? Absolutely. These rules serve a valuable role in helping these villains do what they do, but I think the villains who do this for their own personal reasons fit that noble title a little bit better. In the 1987 movie Predator, an alien game hunter comes to Earth in search of worthy prey. The movie follows a band of jacked, testosterone-fueled Green Berets on a mission that takes them deep into the Vietnamese wilderness. It doesn't take long before the alien identifies them as a good target and, stealthily, begins to pick them off one by one. But eventually, near the movie's climax, one of the veterans proves to be a match for him. And, when challenged to combat, the alien meets the man, warrior to warrior, discarding its futuristic weapons and armor. A ruthless killer, yes, but one with a code of honor. It will only fight a worthy adversary. But that's still kind of rulesy, right? I would consider it anti-villain behavior, sure, but just barely. I think I like it a bit more when a character who we take to be a ruthless villain encounters an ethical boundary that they just don't have the heart to cross. In Disney's Treasure Planet, the notorious pirate Long John Silver gives up his chance to abscond with a boatload of treasure in order to save Jim Hawkins, the teenage cabin boy he had bonded with earlier in the movie. Although he had betrayed Jim and held him hostage only a few minutes earlier, apparently, for him, no amount of treasure is worth Jim's life. This is always a meaningful revelation for us as an audience, seeing this new dimension of our villain. Sometimes it even signals that they're heading for a redemption arc, and at some point will either join the good guys or make some heroic self-sacrifice that's supposed to absolve them of their evil deeds. So, that's what happens when you have a character with a villainous goal, but a not-so-villainous method for achieving it. But what does it look like when both the method and the goal are bad, but the motivation is good? That's the territory of the other anti-villain type, the well-intentioned extremist. Thanos technically fits this role, but I think there's another villain who demonstrates it in a far more nuanced fashion. In the first season of the show, The Legend of Korra, we're introduced to the Big Bad, an enigmatic, powerful, mask-wearing villain called Amon, who's threatening to destroy the status quo. And he kind of has a point. See, the world they live in has two kinds of people in it. Benders and non-benders. People who can magically manipulate the elements of earth, wind, fire, and water. And people who can't. As you can imagine, benders have a bit of an inherent edge here. Amon is the leader of the Equalists, a political faction seeking to make benders and non-benders equal. He wants everyone to feel safe from each other and have the same opportunities. A noble cause, right? But like Thanos, that's just his motive. His actual goal is to forcibly strip every single bender of their powers. And if that goal weren't bad enough by itself, his method of achieving it is equally villainous. Kidnapping people, terrorizing the population, and arming his own dangerous paramilitary force. And with that context, he becomes a pretty clear villain, right? He wants something bad, he's willing to do bad things to get it, but his idealistic and virtuous motivation technically makes him an anti-villain. And we can see how delicate that balance is if we tweak things just a little. What if he wanted something good? Like if instead of forcibly stripping benders of their powers, what if his goal was to pass laws to protect non-benders and give them equal rights? And what if he used the same dark methods to achieve that goal? Kidnapping and terrorism. Well, all of a sudden, he actually becomes an anti-hero, right? This brings me to another interesting point. The domains of anti-hero and anti-villain are so close that sometimes it just seems to be a simple matter of perspective. Someone you took to be an anti-hero can very much appear to be an anti-villain if you just change the angle from which you're looking at them. In Stranger Things Season 4, the character Jason is out for revenge against Eddie Munson, the Satanist who ritualistically murdered his girlfriend Chrissy. Except we, as the audience, know that Chrissy was actually murdered by an interdimensional monster. That's not as believable as the satanic sacrifice excuse, though, so good luck trying to convince him of that. It's easy to see Jason as an anti-villain in this scenario, but what if we thought the same thing that he did? What if we really did believe Eddie was responsible for the murder? Wouldn't that make Jason an anti-hero? One piece of information changes the narrative completely. Jason probably wouldn't be doing any of this if he knew the truth. So can he really be considered the bad guy? He's an anti-villain purely because of what we know about the situation, not actually anything he's done. This is an issue you'll run into all the time with these roles. Severus Snape's goals and motivations are a mystery throughout most of the Harry Potter series, but unless you've been in a coma since 2005, you probably know that he kills Dumbledore, and unless you've been in a coma since 2007, you probably know that he was a good guy the whole time. But what if you were in that coma? If you only had access to the first six books, you would almost definitely still classify him as an anti-villain. Similarly, what if the scene in Book 7 where Harry discovers the truth about Snape hadn't happened? Nothing about Snape himself would have changed, but Harry's opinion of him would have been drastically different. And as we experience the book through Harry's eyes, so had ours. So, we have, hopefully, a pretty good definition for what an anti-villain is here, which is great, but our goal is not necessarily to lock down definitions for these things. It's to find new lenses through which we can look at the fiction we love. These labels are less useful as rigid categories than they are as lenses. there's a reason people love to argue about their favorite villain's morality. Could Kylo Ren ever have been redeemed? When does Walter White make the switch from hapless antihero into full-on villain? Is Tyler Durden a demon that tried to drag the hero under? Or the necessary shadow he had to face for growth? When you're having these conversations, you're not really discussing the morality of fictional characters. You're discussing your own morality. And these words, hero, anti-hero, villain, anti-villain, are just the language you use to do it. The complexity here is wonderful, and we honestly don't actually want to undo all of it. Hopefully, this definition can help you to explore it. Speaking of complexity, this video is just a taste of all the interesting stuff we want to do with video creation. There are so many boundaries we haven't pushed yet that we are just aching to. Unfortunately, experiments can be pretty costly. Unlike regular content, you really have no idea how something experimental is going to perform, and doing something new with content creation almost always forces you to dig a little deeper into your wallet. Nevertheless, we have managed to do some pretty weird stuff over the last few years. Like this video about a fantasy setting that basically has gigantic geographic genitalia, or this video about crafting living beings with magic. But the coolest thing we've ever done, hands down, our six-part original series, Worldsmiths, which explores some of the most unique fiction by some of the most unique authors. Junji Ito's weirdly pleasant psychological world of horror, Neil Gaiman's darkly honest approach to writing children's stories, and a bunch of others. We put so much effort into that series, and we are just so proud of it. And the reason we got to do all of that? This stuff that would just be a bit too risky to try here on YouTube? Well, we actually have a completely different streaming platform for it, called Nebula. It's amazing. We literally get paid to do experiments over there. All of our videos upload on Nebula a whole week before they upload here on YouTube, without any ads, and, like I said, all the weird stuff that we're just not able to risk making for YouTube goes up there too. In fact, it's the only place you can see a lot of it, and we're not the only ones who have been posting there. The same is true for so many other amazing creators. The entire platform was built by creators for creators. Every time you watch a video over there, a creator you love is getting paid, and far more than they would ever get paid on YouTube. For a lot of us over there, it's become the single best way to fund our more experimental, ambitious content, like our original series, Worldsmiths. And here's the really fun part. You can get Nebula for cheaper than almost any other streaming platform on the internet. Like $2.50 per month. That cheap. We want you to have access to our Nebula content, so we've managed to get Tale Foundry fans who sign up using our link a whole 40% off the usual rate. All you have to do is click the link in the description or go to go.nebula.tv/talefoundry and sign up for 1 year. That's it. And with our discount on that first year, the whole year is only going to be $30, which again comes out to just $2.50 per month. Frankly, I'm not quite sure how they can afford to do this for us, but I'm definitely not complaining. Seriously, take advantage of this offer while it's still going. I don't think a better one exists in the world of streaming. Anyway, that's all for this one. Thanks for watching, and keep making stuff up. I'll see you next week. Bye!